This is Law and Disorder.
In this third of our four-part series, Law and Disorder examines surveillance after 9/11. We'll speak with Michael Ratner, who's just back from Germany.
We just filed a 380-page complaint in German charging Donald Rumsfeld and other high U.S. administration officials with war crimes.
We'll talk to Mike Steinberg of the ACLU of Michigan about NSA spying.
The National Security Agency is engaged in warrantless wiretapping. We're winning some lawsuits, but the fight isn't over.
We'll talk to Stephen Wax, who's the federal public defender for the District of Oregon, who represented Brandon Mayfield.
Brandon Mayfield was accused of being involved in the Ochoa, Spain train bombing. It all turned out to be a fake, but his, sadly, is only one of hundreds, maybe thousands of cases of criminal and other harassment of Muslims all over this country.
And we'll talk to a student who found himself tracked in America.
He's only one of a representative of many, many anti-war groups that were surveilled in Operation Talon.
And we'll speak with the National Lawyers Guild about violent gang and terrorist organization files that are being kept now.
You know, when I was a lawyer in the 60s and 70s, we litigated against huge files that were kept by the administration, the terrorist index, the communist index. It's amazing to see that we're doing that again.
All that and more on this, the third part of our special four-part series, Surveillance and Criminalization of Dissent.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Michael Ratner, welcome back from Germany. I saw your name all over the international press. You went there to try to get Donald Rumsfeld indicted as a war criminal. Tell us, what did Rumsfeld do, and why'd you go to Germany, and how can you get him indicted in Germany?
You know, it turned out to be an extraordinary event in Berlin. I was in Berlin with a group of other human rights groups, lawyers, etc., to try and get them to begin a criminal investigation of Donald Rumsfeld. And other U.S. officials, George Tenet, former head of the CIA, some of the lawyers, Ewan Bibby, who wrote the torture memos. Our main plaintiffs in the case were 12 Iraqis who had been tortured at Abu Ghraib and at other places in Iraq. One of our plaintiffs, though, was also a man named Mohammed El-Khatani. Mohammed El-Khatani was in Guantanamo, still is, and he's the one that we got, I mean, an incredible link with Rumsfeld, because he was tortured for a period of 2 months, and there's a log that was actually of his torture that was actually exposed by Time magazine originally that went over what happened to him, and Donald Rumsfeld essentially approved that log as it went along. So we had Rumsfeld really dead in the water on the fact that he committed war crimes. And then you had a situation where in the United States, they've amnestied these guys for war crimes under the Military Commissions Act. So you have a situation where there is actually an opportunity for European countries who have what's called universal jurisdiction, a Pinochet-type jurisdiction, to actually go after these guys.
Explain what universal jurisdiction is.
Well, think about a pirate, Dahlia. Piracy was considered an international crime, and any country had an obligation, not just a right, but an obligation to bring a pirate to justice. In the modern time, we look at war crimes, such as torture, as similar to piracy. And those people are considered enemies of all human beings. It's called hostis humanis generis in Latin. Latin, actually. It means they're enemies of every one of us. And therefore, every country has the obligation to bring those people to justice. And Germany has actually set up a special law called universal jurisdiction because it has universal jurisdiction to prosecute people for war crimes. Germany and a number of other countries do. But they can only do that when the home country isn't going to do it. And now we know that the home country, the United States, isn't going to do it because they, one, they haven't done it for three or four years now. And secondly, they have a law now that says they won't do it.
Bush said quite clearly, we do not torture. Who do we believe here? What did Rumsfeld do? What kind of proof do you have of what Rumsfeld did?
I think it's now basically acknowledged the U.S. has a torture program. Whether we call it torture or whether we call it a violation of the Geneva Conventions and of the humanitarian provisions of those, whatever label you want to put on it, most of the journalists, and there were literally scores of journalists who talked to us about this, they sort of accept that, yeah, we did this. But then they say to me either, well, isn't it an effective method against terrorism? Or they say, well, isn't this just going to fail. And what I say to them is, we know what Rumsfeld did here. Rumsfeld not only signed the torture logs or basically authorized al-Qahtani's torture, but he signed papers and authorizations for everything from stress positions, chaining to the floor, dogs, stripping, hooding, the whole business. So whether we call that cruel treatment or torture is not the issue. In either case, they're war crimes. And you can prosecute these guys for war crimes. The real question that people ask is, well, is this really going to work in Germany? What I say to people, really, already this has worked. Already, when Rumsfeld resigned, and it was actually here in the studio at BAI when I first read the email that said Rumsfeld resigned, everybody was only talking about, you know, oh, he's resigned, and what did he do wrong with the way he fought the war in Iraq, and these kinds of things. Now Rumsfeld's name is linked to torture in the public media and the public mind. So in some way, we've already been successful with this case. This mere filing of this case, not mere because it's a 320-page complaint in German, you can actually go to the CCR website, ccr-ny.org. It has lots of material on it, including the way to send a letter to the German prosecutor to say, go after this guy. So this has actually had a big effect. And even today, as we speak, Rumsfeld probably afraid to go to Germany right now.
Well, how can we make him afraid to go anywhere else? What's the laws in the rest of the EU?
Well, it's actually, if the Germans issue an arrest warrant and he doesn't have to know about it and he goes to another EU country, they can arrest him. He could be. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but then we're thinking of going to other countries as well. I mean, the Spanish who prosecuted Pinochet, also, I have an open court like this, and maybe even more independence than the German prosecutors. And so we're looking at that in the next couple of months. We want, basically, our view is there should be no safe haven for torturers. Whether I see Rumsfeld go to jail or not, well, that's not really the issue for us. The issue is, first, accountability. And for our clients, who are the victims of this, they want to see it acknowledged that they were tortured and that it was wrong to do it. I mean, for them, that is absolutely crucial.
What kind of consciousness exists in Europe about what you tried to do? Would you say that more people in Europe are aware of Rumsfeld being named a torturer than here in the United States? What kind of press did it get? What kind of presence?
Well, surprisingly, we got a lot of press here in the U.S. 2 years ago, we didn't get anything when we first tried this. I got to Europe a week ago, and there's a front page story, 6 pages long, with everything about this case. I mean, pictures of everybody, you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights Library, the whole business. You know, on one level, Europe's very upset with this. They have this case. They have in Italy, of course, people know they've indicted 20 or so CIA agents for kidnapping an Egyptian cleric off the streets. Germany, they have a similar situation. They may well indict CIA people for the kidnapping of al-Masri out of Macedonia, completely innocent guy. He was on a bus on the way from Germany to Macedonia, kidnapped, rendered, tortured in Afghanistan. And one of the cases, Spain is now looking at it now, because all these CIA guys, after they kidnap these people, they vacation at a hotel in Mallorca, and they vacation under their own names. They even buy occasionally at night pornographic films, according to the records of the Spanish magistrate who's looking into it. But they all dumbly go to the Spanish hotel in Mallorca. And so now Europe is getting somewhere. Look, Europe talks out of the side of its mouth also, because on one level, they're very close to the United States. And another level, some of the judges are a little independent. So there's some movement for sure. And I think, to me, what the Rumsfeld case represented, and the reaction particularly, is that the world is changing a little bit, even in the U.S. I mean, the idea that the Times would put in a long article about this indicates that that people have had it with Rumsfeld and they've had it with torture on some level.
We all remember Brandon Mayfield, the Muslim attorney in Portland, Oregon, who was picked up on a material witness warrant and held, publicly accused of being the Madrid train bomber, despite the fact that he had an expired passport and hadn't left the country in quite some time. And he was held publicly accused, and a smear campaign was set upon him, despite the fact that the government had little to no evidence to connect him to the crime. He's a guy that you would think they wouldn't really touch, and they came up with nothing to really destroy his life, to hold him in prison and publicly accuse him of doing this horrible crime that he didn't commit. But the other part of this is we got an inside look into what the government is doing every day across this country, this secret surveillance. They went into his home. They downloaded the contents of several computers. They took photographs. They took DNA samples. When you're joking about putting that Q-tip in the trash and having your DNA sample on it, that's what they did to him. They fished in his trash and they took this stuff. They took the contents of his children's computers. One of his children had written an essay, a junior high school essay, opposing the invasion of Afghanistan as a response to what happened on 9/11. So we're really pleased to have with us today Steve Wax, who's the federal public defender for the District of Oregon, who handled Brandon's case in those early days when he was a material witness. Steve Wax, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be here.
Steve, tell us about your client Brandon Mayfield and his case.
Brandon was arrested on May 6, 2004 on a material witness warrant that allegedly connected him to the bombings that had taken place in Spain in March of that year, in which 191 people were killed and more than 2,000 were injured. Among the people who were killed were three Americans. The warrant that was used to arrest Mr. Mayfield listed a number of terrorism statutes that are on the U.S. books that could have led to a death penalty had he been charged and convicted.
Well, what we remember about this case, a lot of us, is that Brandon Mayfield, he was picked up on this material witness warrant, and we've been covering this for a while, so our listeners will remember that the material witness warrant is a warrant that allows the federal government to pick up and hold somebody who is a witness if they need them, and then that allows them not to charge that person. That person doesn't have to have an attorney. That person can just be held.
Well, the person does have a right to counsel,
ah.
And that's how we got into the case. Among the material witness statute issues that Mr. Mayfield's case generated were whether or not it was an appropriate use of the statute to pick him up. Among the documents that have come out since I concluded my representation of him through the civil litigation, which is currently ongoing with other counsel, are some internal documents and emails from one FBI office to another, as well as reports that came from leaks out of FBI and DOJ people in Washington, which include statements that they never had any intention of questioning him. Never thought that they would ever get any information from him, which raises a question as to whether or not the use of the material witness warrant to arrest him was appropriate. Or it was a device that was used to hold him while they hoped to generate enough information to actually indict him.
And they did that to scores of Muslim men across the country. He's not the only one.
That's for sure.
I remember vaguely the affidavit in the case that had to do with him being, I don't know if I mentioned that he was a convert to Muslim, the Muslim religion, but I do remember something about him representing somebody in a custody case who was then accused of a terrorism crime, which is one piece of evidence. Another piece was that he was prayed at a mosque that maybe the same guy was a member of. And then the third thing was something about a fingerprint. Can you just talk about some of those issues?
Sure. The first and main part of the affidavit was related to the fingerprint. The eighth paragraph of the affidavit described the FBI analysis of a latent print that had been lifted from a bag at one of the train stations in Spain, compared with Mr. Mayfield's prints, and the FBI declared a 100% identification. That's the language in the warrant. Now, I tried my first criminal case now 32 years ago, and I don't recall ever seeing a report that used the phrase 100% before.
Amazing. That's really, I didn't realize that. I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, but that's quite interesting.
Yeah. And as it turned out, they were 100% wrong.
But it took a while for them to be convinced for some reason that they were 100% wrong. There was a story about how they flew to Spain with the fingerprint, and the Spanish said to them, this ain't the fingerprint.
I remember after the whole case blew up in the press, the New York Times on the front page had the fingerprint that was found on the bag in Madrid, Brandon Mayfield's fingerprint, or maybe it was a thumbprint, I can't remember what, but they put them side by side. And it was obvious that visually it wasn't a match. So it was a little bit striking to read that they had said it was a 100% match and even argued with Spanish authorities that they were wrong. It was indeed a 100% match.
What happened is that the Spaniards sent out through Interpol the latent print in early March. And the FBI received the prints. There are actually two different transmissions, March 13, I recall, and March 17. On the 13th of April, the Spanish sent the FBI a letter that had in bold in it the word negative. Spanish telling the FBI in mid-April that their analysis was that it was not Mr. Mayfield's print. Subsequent to that, April 21 and 22, a team of FBI agents, none of whom spoke Spanish, went to Spain, met with the Spaniards, with the Spanish FBI agent Legat, and they had a discussion. The results of that discussion are in dispute. The FBI reported in the affidavit for search warrant that at the end of the discussion, the Spaniards were convinced by their analysis. Spaniards, as reported in the New York Times in that June 5 article, the head of the Spanish National Police Forensic Unit, said, no, we were not, and we never told them that. The Inspector General of the Department of Justice did an analysis of the case, and one of the chapters in his report involves the communication between the FBI and the Spanish in April. And it's clear that the FBI and the Spaniards are describing that meeting differently. It's also clear that what was put into the affidavits in support of the search and arrest warrants was the FBI view, not the Spanish.
The Spanish were saying, look, this is the wrong guy. Why would they hold Brandon Mayfield? What's the reasoning behind that?
You have to ask them that question. All I can do is tell you that the FBI perspective of the meeting that took place the week after they received that letter is they convinced the Spanish. I think it's also important to go back to the other paragraphs of the affidavit because they provide some context here. It says Brandon represented Battle in a child custody matter. Paragraph 14, I think, is one of the most troubling in the affidavit because what it does is describe Jeffrey Battle's views that Battle was said to have engaged in jihad.
Wait, it attributed the views of the client to the attorney that represented him on an unrelated matter.
One could draw that inference. The paragraph says these are Battle's views. The question that I'm posing is, why do you put that into an affidavit in support of the arrest and search of an attorney?
Well, they went into his home and collected DNA samples, right? I mean, what do they collect? Hair? They downloaded the contents of some computers,
correct,
to children's essays.
Well, precisely what they took under the FISA searches, I don't know. Don't know that we'll ever know. It's conceivable that that information will come out through the civil lawsuit. It's also possible that we will never know. In addition to the FISA searches, at the same time as Brandon's arrest, there were traditional searches conducted pursuant to a warrant issued by district judge here in Portland. My understanding that the homework, for example, was seized pursuant to the local district court traditional warrant rather than the FISA warrant.
Steve Wax, let me ask,
sure,
having been Brandon Mayfield's attorney through all this, what do you believe this case really says about where we are in America now after 9/11?
To me, it's an example of the way in which fear can distort the process. It is an example of the way in which an innocent man was in fact hurt as a result of the conduct of the war on terror. It should say to all of us, if this can happen to an attorney in Portland, Oregon, a man who spent 10 years in our military, retired as a lieutenant, a man who actually voted, as he has said, for George Bush, it can happen to anyone. And we need to be cautious about the liberties that we all enjoy when dealing with the terrorism issue, because it's very easy for them to slip away.
Steve Wax, Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Steve.
Bye-bye now.
As part of the broad surveillance that has taken place in this country post 9/11, we're going to talk about the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping of Americans and of a lot of other people. Once that wiretapping was exposed, it has been widely challenged in the courts. It's been challenged by the ACLU in a Michigan case. It's been challenged by the Center for Constitutional Rights in a New York case. And it's been challenged by the Electronic Frontier Foundation in another case against the telephone companies. So far, there's actually been one victory, and that's in the Michigan case. And we're now going to talk to one of the lawyers in that case from the ACLU of Michigan, Michael Steinberg. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
As I spoke to our listeners, I talked about the fact that there were a few cases out there challenging warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And I know you guys in the ACLU have had a victory out in Michigan. Why don't you give us a little bit of background to how this was exposed, and then tell us a little bit about the victory and where the case is now.
Sure. Well, the policy of NSA wiretapping was actually exposed by the New York Times. We found out about it, thought it was unconstitutional.
To remind our listeners, we've been following this story for some time, but remind our listeners what the policy of NSA spying was.
Sure. The National Security Agency was and may still be doing, what they still may be doing is wiretapping calls that either begin in the U.S. and go abroad or come into the U.S. from abroad. They tape record and make transcripts of certain calls.
I'm calling Egypt, and they're recording. They might be recording my call and transcribing it.
It also applies to email communication.
How do they know where your email's going?
They have their ways.
There's some kind of computer they back onto that can read all of the emails in some kind of sorting way or something.
A lot of the program is unknown, and it's been kept secret, and they're unwilling to tell Congress about it. But the government has tried to defend it, and they tried to defend it publicly. We believed it's unconstitutional, and we filed the case in Detroit on behalf of journalists and scholars and criminal defense attorneys who deal with individuals abroad in the Middle East and elsewhere, and who had strong concerns that their communications were being tapped. Instead of being able to speak with individuals abroad, they actually had to travel to the Middle East or elsewhere to engage in these communications. So they were suffering concrete harm, and we filed the case in Detroit. We recently won a victory there. The judge held that even in times of crises, the Constitution still exists, and that this is not a country with hereditary kings. Those were her words, and that there's checks and balances. And the government was thumbing its nose at Congress and at the Constitution.
Well, Michael, that's a great result. What's next?
On Monday, we filed our brief in the U.S. Court of Appeals, expect oral argument in either January or February, and then most observers think that this case or another one like it will go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Michael Steinberg from the ACLU in Michigan, you won that wonderful victory. I thought the judge's decision was right on, but afterwards there was a big campaign in the press to discredit her as a scholar, to say she was a lightweight, to really go after her. What kind of news coverage did you have about that in Michigan?
Well, it was covered. Certainly. There was a campaign ready to go when the opinion came out, if it came out the wrong way. They also tried to discredit her because she sits on a board that one time in the past on the board had given some money to the ACLU. It was a very little bit for a project that had nothing to do with this.
Do you have an argument date in the circuit court yet?
No.
Okay, let me ask you a question about where we are in legislation. I know that, you know, it hasn't gone well in Congress in the sense that we haven't really been able to get much anything through about this. And now, of course, we have the Democrats in, but we have a lame duck sitting there right now, lame duck session. And I know there's some legislation to try and legalize some of this warrantless wiretapping. Are you familiar with where we are on that?
Yes. You know, our national office is very much involved in Washington in lobbying against that. And we're somewhat hopeful that it won't go through in the lame duck session.
By the time it gets to the Supreme Court 2 years from now, they could rule it constitutional. So we're living in perilous times. Michael Steinberg from the ACLU in Michigan, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
My own opinion is this spine is here to stay, regardless of Michael Steinberg's excellent legal work in Michigan or the electronic frontier people. I don't think Congress is going to overturn this legislation. I don't think the Supreme Court's going to overturn this legislation.
Well, there's no legislation, Michael. Let's know. Right now, there's legislation that says that this is illegal, completely illegal. So the question is one, is Congress going to make it legal somehow?
That's what I mean.
Or is the court going to hold it unconstitutional? I think in the current court, I think they'll hold it unconstitutional.
The current court could change any minute. You got one of the good guys, Stevens, is like, 87 years old?
We're not going to win this necessarily the way we want, but I think we're going to win it. They are not going to allow this kind of warrantless wiretapping.
Well, what happens with the years of wiretapping that they've collected, the years of data, emails, phone calls?
Well, we still have a couple of years for this probably, Dahlia, right? Before this case wends its way to the Supreme Court, we're talking about another couple of years in which the president is clearly committed an utterly impeachable offense. He's taken a statute that's been on the books for years. Not only has the statute been on the books for years, but if post 9/11, and no doubt you were at the ACLU then, they passed the Patriot Act. President went to Congress and said, look at you guys, I don't have enough authority to wiretap some Americans. I'll do a warrant in the secret court, but give me a little more authority. Congress gives him some more authority. The Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU were both trashing that legislation.
We thought it was terrible.
Right, that he gave them more authority to wiretap Americans. The ball was hidden. It was the hidden ball trick. We're out there worrying about the Patriot Act, and he's doing warrantless wiretapping. So he actually went to Congress for more authority, got the authority, and then he basically said, let him worry about that. I'll do warrantless wiretapping. I think he's going to be struck down flat on this thing, in fact. I think Congress may give him more, but I don't necessarily agree with Michael on this. I think this one is too basic, but I don't, you know, you don't know.
You don't know what's going to happen in this country between now and 2 years from now.
I think the tide is turning. That's my view is, even if we got a bunch of Democrats who are afraid of their own shadow in there, I mean, I think the tide is turning on this stuff. Look what happened to Rumsfeld. Just look at what happened to that guy. That guy is not like dirt in the sand. He's a scapegoat. He's a guilty scapegoat, but he's a scapegoat for a war that should not have happened. But in terms of
the NSA spying,
hopeful will not be the right word. These struggles take years, as you know, Michael, from Vietnam. Even when we, in 68, had the most powerful movement in this country, it took 8 years to get us out of there, and they still had an economic blockade. So this is years of struggle. But I do think that some things are turning.
But people are still not awake to what's really happening. Yesterday, someone approached me and said, oh, my God, where I work, I just found out that they hang on to your emails even after you've deleted it from your inbox. They hang on to your email for 2 years. And I said, well, actually, that's pretty standard, and you have a lot more to be worried about than your company hanging on to your email for 2 years. I mean, there just was no sense that our own government spies on us. I think we were all brought up and taught that we live in the land of the free, that our government is really hands-off when it comes to our personal lives and our private lives, as they should be, that there is really, despite how many times this may appear on the front page, there is still not the sense that the government is watching us.
The one thing I think that Michael, that a point that maybe even if we, I mean, some modified way, or still require a warrant for American citizens, they'll make it more broad. But I do think Dahlia's point that it may be that they spy on us no matter what happens. I mean, I think they will be doing this kind of surveillance no matter what the law
says. Once you get a taste
even
for
it, even too. If the court says this is no good, they're going to have a machine that reads all of our emails, and it's going to pick up keywords, and it's going to pick up the word Michael Ratner, or the word, you know, Dahlia Hashad, or whatever, and they're going to keep doing it.
Well, don't make people scared to email us now, but this is what the government is doing this, and they will continue to do this, and I worry about as it's being normalized within government. New people are coming into government every day, and they are taught that this is what we do, this is our job, and to them it is. Thank you.
as it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back and chained, to deny us of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see, the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, while it's freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promise me emancipation, and this new nation, all you ever gave my people was salvation, fathers of this country never cared for me, they kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery, and Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me, sat lying about the facts in my history, so now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed, but the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down, so they can screw us around, time to change the government now, Panther power, Panther power, Panther power.
It's good to have Konstanty Hordynski here on Law and Disorder. Konstanty Hordynski's parents immigrated here from Poland during a time when the Polish people were suffering from an intrusive authoritarian government. Kat became an activist against the Iraq War at the University of California in Santa Cruz, only to find out that a branch of the U.S. Pentagon was spying on his anti-war group. Konstanty Hordynski?
Yeah.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
You're an anti-war activist out there in Santa Cruz, the University of California branch in California. And I understand that you've had some encounters here with the American government that you didn't quite expect when you had immigrated from your native Poland. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what's going on at the University of California in Santa Cruz.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, I'm an organizer in a group called Students Against War at UC Santa Cruz. That was formed in early 2005, actually on the eve of George Bush's second inauguration. And so we're sort of a broad-based anti-war organization that really seeks to, as we see it, demilitarize society in all of its forms, and specifically with a focus on our campus and what we can do locally. We do a lot of counter-recruitment work in sort of the Santa Cruz area, in the high schools, because a lot of the time that's really where the unfair kind of recruitment practices happen.
How many people are in your group?
You know, we don't have a membership role. We try to be as broad-based, and we don't have any officers or anything like that, but consistently to our meetings, about 40 people come out, and then on our listservs, we have two listservs that probably cover about another 200, and then there's an action or something going on, then even more people come out.
And how would you rate your effectiveness out there in Santa Cruz?
You know, I like to think we're pretty effective. You know, obviously, in general, these sort of work is kind of hard. You know, we're always striving to have a more direct change. But I think we've been pretty happy with what we do.
Kat Hordynski, I guess the government has been equally unhappy with what you're doing. Tell us what you've discovered about government surveillance of Students Against War.
Right. They definitely have been unhappy, it seems. In December of 2005, actually about a year ago now, a report came out that listed Students Against War on what it called, what was a Talon database sort of document. This MSNBC report that came out listed that, and we, as Students Against War, found our April 5th action. It was a counter-recruitment action on campus, listed in that document as a credible threat.
Now, this is Talon, T-A-L-O-N,
yes,
and this, as I recall, is something to do with the Pentagon surveillance system?
Indeed, yeah. I believe the way it's characterized is that it's a monitoring system for potential threats to military installations and threats of terrorism.
And how'd you find out that they were onto you?
You know, we had no idea, really, until the MSNBC report came out.
And how'd you react when you found out?
It's funny, actually, because it was winter break, none of us were at school. And we read about this, we saw it in the news, and then a few people emailed the listserv, and our first reaction was one of, we were just really taken aback, seeing our group's name in a national news report, and then on top of that in a Pentagon database was fairly shocking.
Was the Pentagon the only government institution that was monitoring you?
I'm not actually sure. We've since filed a FOIA request and a number of those, but we haven't really found out who and how they were monitoring us. And honestly, when I say Pentagon, I mean sort of the military, the government.
But you were saying how people felt, and I'm interested in, did it have an effect? I mean, you guys are students. I remember when I was a student that if the students were not necessarily as progressive or thinking of a career in law or something, they got very nervous about these kind of things. Now, was there any of that among your membership or people that you spoke to that said, well, my gosh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
I think we were definitely very worried. I don't think there was ever a thought that we should stop what we're doing. I think we were, if anything, I would even say, maybe mobilized by this, you know, sort of a reaction of, wow, this is really going on. These are serious times, sort of. And so, you know, we should be doing what we're doing. And then perhaps even as I like to see it, sometimes, you know, as students and organizers who are constantly striving for more attention to our issues, we smiled a little bit. We thought maybe Pentagon's noticing what we're doing, then maybe we are doing something right.
Yeah, really. Hey, Kat Hordynski, your folks came here from Poland. What's your reaction to the United States doing this stuff to peaceful peace activists?
I think it's a sad reality for this government, for the state of affairs here, if we can say, you know, Poland under communist regime and America in 2006 or 2005 in the same sentence. At the same time, you know, I think it's really important to keep these things in somewhat of a perspective. I think I would be the last person to really say that what was going on in Poland and in the former Soviet bloc is really going on here. But, you know, it's shocking to think that what we think of America is just so, in some ways, so untrue, you know, as a freedom, a beacon of freedom and kind of a really open society, which in many ways it is. But when we as peaceful students find ourselves on a Pentagon watch list, I think that really has grave implications for for the rest of society.
You know, I think with the high-tech capacities that the United States has developed, they probably put whatever Poland did in the shade.
This was part of the whole program. The one that became famous, because your case was one, but the other was with the Quaker group in Florida, right? This is the same.
Exactly.
What's happened now to this Talon program? What's happened to any lawsuits or FOIA requests? Anything going forward that do we still know what's going on?
You know? Right. Well, we've, as Students Against War and some of the two or three other kind of more local groups in the San Francisco Bay Area and Santa Cruz area, have filed a number of FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, with the ACLU of Northern California. And we've gotten actually, you know, a whole bunch of documents, I would say over 200 pages of documents, but nothing that is really the proverbial smoking gun. You know, we don't really know how we found ourselves on that list, why we were there. And then the Pentagon or the sort of the military, the branch that controls the Talon program, has since said that this was a mistake. You know, they've admitted that putting us on the list was not the best use of military money and thought and whatnot. But, you know, we feel that it's not enough to say that this was something that happened by mistake and it's okay now. You know, we really have to find out why we were there and make sure that this kind of stuff doesn't happen again.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting point, to make sure that this kind of stuff doesn't happen again. And you are actually part of the Tracked in America series that's featured. People can go to our Law and Disorder webpage to get a link to that, lawanddisorder.org or amnestyusa.org/US to connect into that. We'll play a clip from your piece on there. However, one of the things that's really important for people to remember is while this is happening now, it's not new. This type of thing has been happening for a very long time, and that's what Tracked in America does. It brings the voices of individuals who've been surveilled and tracked by this government and other governments in the U.S. for a couple hundred years. So we'd like to play a clip from Kat Hordynski on Tracked in America.
The military comes every year, at least once a year, to the campus career fair at UC Santa Cruz. And so on April 5th of 2005, the military came to campus. We had held a rally there at the career fair. At the same time, people walked into the career fair from Students Against War. We had about, I would say, 20 people that went inside and formed lines as if they were interested in joining the military and asked the military repeatedly questions about the recruiting practices that would sort of tie them up and not allow them to recruit any other people. They were then shut out by the career fair staff and some police, and there was somewhat of a skirmish when people were trying to go inside and we weren't being let in. But after a little bit, that stopped, and we had a big rally outside of the career fair. So this rally made it onto the Pentagon's list. It was in one column highlighted as a credible threat. When I found out that our group had made it onto the Pentagon's list, I had sort of a twofold reaction. on the one hand, I was kind of scared. I felt like that my paranoid fears of being under surveillance or of the government listening into what we were doing were coming true, that those fears were actually a little bit more realistic than I had thought until then. On the other hand, it really all made me very angry and at the same time motivated to do more, because I realized that if a peaceful group on the UC Santa Cruz campus, where we have obviously no connections to any sort of terrorism or anything like that, has made it onto a terrorist watch list, there's something profoundly wrong.
That was Kat Hordinsky on Tracked in America. Kat, what's it been like to be part of this series that connects what's happened to you with what's happened to so many other people?
I have to say it's been really amazing. I mean, for two reasons. You know, one, to be in such good company. As you mentioned, the website and the documentary go back so far in history and kind of through the civil rights movement and even before, to show that this stuff has been going on for a long time. And it's amazing to be in that company and have Students Against War be a part of that. I think the other part of it is that the website, I think, is pretty effective at getting its point across. And I know that it's sort of targeted as a teaching aid, and it really, I think, it does well at that. It's very interactive and colorful and exciting. You know, I've been showing everybody here, and I think it's really amazing to get the story out and at the same time be featured as part of something that I think is going to get to a lot of people.
Kat Hordinsky, thanks so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kat.
All right.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've covered the resurgence of domestic surveillance since the events of September 11. We've seen how the government has loosened restrictions on spying on political activists, both locally and nationally. And we've also seen how this administration has exploited the term terrorism to justify a host of insidious and often unlawful practices. From engaging in mass arrests of peaceful protesters in order to collect information about political affiliations, to categorizing and labeling individuals based on their ideologies. We've also seen how all this information is being assembled into a comprehensive terrorism watch list called the Terrorist Screening Database. Today we bring you an exclusive report on the FBI's Violent Gang and Terrorist Organization File, or VGTOF. The VGTOF is the watch list's main source of domestic terrorist information. It includes names of individuals with no criminal history who are being investigated as being politically active or connected with politically active organizations. Within 2 years, the database has increased from 7,000 to 100,000 individuals in June 2005. In 2002, an FBI memo stated that it will include anarchists, animal rights extremists, environmental extremists, and domestic extremists on the list. Officials don't have to justify the decision to place someone on the list, and the list can be accessed by virtually every law enforcement official with whom the person comes into contact. Joining us today is attorney Gideon Oliver and law students Grania O'Neill and Mark Taylor. Gideon has represented protesters unlawfully arrested at the Republican National Convention and at the monthly bicycle ride Critical Mass. All are members of the New York City chapter National Lawyers Guild Board of Directors. Grania, Mark, and Gideon, you've all been actively involved in Critical Mass and in raising awareness of the police department's proposed parade permit regulations. And Grania, you've written at depth about the VGTOF in an unpublished research paper. Welcome to Law and Disorder. Gideon, for several years now, you've been a careful analyst of domestic surveillance. Can you tell us how you think the terrorism database fits into the big picture of police crackdowns on dissent in this country?
Certainly. One very clear example comes out of Portland, Oregon. Portland had one of the first joint terrorism task forces in the nation. And JTTFs are these partnership entities that involve mostly city, state, federal, and tribal law enforcement agents, but in some cases appear to also involve private partners, and it's unclear exactly what that means. At any rate, in Portland, as a result of the establishment of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, it appears that sort of analytical model behind the VGTOF, which seemed to come at the question of how do we deal with organized gangs and really track relationships among people and communities in order to have a system of targeting individuals for selective treatment, at least on a certain level. If you look at some of the surveillance video taken at peaceful protests and demonstrations by Portland, Oregon law enforcement officers from 2002 and 2003, there are repeated examples of these officers who are filming saying things like, "I recognize that guy, he's the organizer, Cancio says to get him." And you can actually see on the tape, you know, at say like a 10-person demonstration where a person is just holding a sign, that for no apparent reason at all, as a result of this surveillance, the police officers are ordered, it seems by perhaps FBI agents at the Terrorism Screening Center or JTTF officers from some agency, to just snatch this person out of the crowd.
Like a snatch squad where they go in and pluck someone out. Gideon, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces around this country were created right before September 11?
There are certainly JTTFs that were created before September 11th. Portland and Denver are two that come to mind right off the top of my head. And it's certain that surveillance of perceived activist groups by the JTTFs had been going on well before September 11th. There was a lawsuit that the Civil Liberties Union in Denver brought on behalf of the American Friends Service Committee in 2003 that actually indicates that the federal government propagated, beginning in 2001, a training manual created by, it's unclear which agency, the affidavit just says the United States government, identifying civil disturbance and protest tactics, giving instructions on how to respond to those tactics. So it seems that through the JTTFs and probably other avenues, there's a real federal coordination of increasing surveillance of protest groups.
The government is trying to identify what they call recognizable groups among protesters, with trying to identify leaders and take pictures of these people.
And share that information on a level that's just completely unprecedented. And then, I think, exhibit a real, when oversight hearings are held.
Oversight of law enforcement?
Yes, or the requests from municipal governments or from the federal government designed to test the quality of some of this information. The law enforcement response is really always to just say, we can't talk about it because we'd be giving the terrorists too much information, and trust us.
Grania, could you briefly give us an overview of how the VGTOF works?
Sure, Heidi, thanks. The VGTOF was created in 1995 to add a new dimension to the National Crime Information Center. It was designed to give law enforcement agencies sharing information over violent gangs and terrorist organizations. Now, it was created right after the Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center bombing, and sort of used in at that time. So right after 9/11, prior to the 2002 Winter Olympics, there was a similar public outcry about terrorism, and the FBI then broadened the VGTOF to include anarchists, animal rights extremists, environmental extremists, and a host of other right-wing organizations. But what the file does is that it shares information between local police departments nationally with the FBI, and then using new procedures implemented in 2000, 3. It shares it with the State Department, who can then share this information to our allies. What this means is that a local police officer on a routine traffic stop will run a license plate. Basically, what they're doing is they're checking at the National Crime Information Center to see if this person has outstanding warrants or if the car is stolen or if they're wanted. And now, because the VGTOF has been included in the National Crime Information Center, they're also getting responses that say things like, caution, possible terrorist, may be armed and dangerous, proceed with caution. This is information that has not been before a judge. This person has no knowledge of their inclusion in the VGTOF. So at this routine traffic stop or a red light, there's a heightened level of concern. There's a heightened level of altercation between the two.
Grania, how many people are in the database?
It's really interesting, Heidi. As of May of 2003, there were 7,000 names in the database. But then by 2005, that number had increased to 100,000. And there's no data on how many are in there today.
Now, isn't it true that the officer is not permitted to tell the individual that he or she is on the list?
Yes. I think Gideon has some documents, I think, that show that it says, do not alert this individual to inclusion on the list. However, you know, local police procedures are often sloppy. There is a case of someone in Denver who overheard, and he and his colleagues overheard that he was a terrorist. He'd been labeled a terrorist by the FBI.
Are there any guidelines for entering someone into the database? What's the safety net?
Some agencies are very thorough in who they're entering, and some are only entering people because they think that they might know someone. So there was a Government Accountability Office study done, and it showed that about 40% of the information was in error. What the government's response to that was that they really wanted to err on the side of caution. And by caution, they did not mean protecting American civil liberties. They meant putting more people in the database.
There's actually been a very recent GAO report to congressional requesters about terrorist watch list screening. It's a September 2006 report that doesn't mention the VGTOF at all, but it, I think, raises some very interesting questions for the VGTOF, or with respect to the VGTOF. And it, specifically, the GAO report says, well, you know, there are these watch lists, and we really can't talk about them, and we can't tell people whether or not they're on them. And basically, if someone thinks they're on one of these lists, perhaps after the fifth or tenth time they experience a, you know, difficulty boarding a plane or, you know, on a job application or something like that, they'll complain.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Gideon Oliver, Grania O'Neill, and Mark Taylor, all board members of the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. We're talking about the FBI's Violent Gang and Terrorist Organization file, or VGTOF. One of the patterns that many of us in the National Lawyers Guild have noticed is the creation of legislation that, in effect, does target specific groups. We just saw, as we mentioned earlier, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act going after animal rights groups, and the regulations going after the bicyclists. Is this to make the government look as though it is doing its job in rooting out terrorism?
I think it's a combination of trying to look like they're doing something and wanting to have control over public gatherings. It's not like they're really hiding as undercovers. They're really trying to intimidate people. They're trying to keep people from demonstrating and from, you know, gathering and going to meetings. You know, and I think it certainly has that effect. You can't go to political meetings these days and not realize you're very likely to have an undercover there, to have your name entered into a database. And it has a real chilling effect on people organizing against what the government's doing.
That's right. Yet another tactic in the crackdown on dissent in this country.
What ends up happening in criminal court when people are swept up in a mass arrest, an individual police officer has not observed them do anything to violate a law. What ends up happening is that it's an opportunity for law enforcement officers to sort of buff these databases without ever having to tell anyone they're doing it. People who end up getting swept up in these arrests have no way of challenging this tagging the way they've been tagged. In New York City, Eileen Clancy of Eyewitness Video has been really instrumental in investigating a lot of the police practices on the ground in terms of mass arrest during the RNC and during the critical mass riots since.
Thank you, Mark, Grania, and Gideon for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Heidi.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Heidi.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.